From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in today for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump tweeted this morning, his 200th day in office, that he's hard at work at a summer home in New Jersey while he's on vacation and the White House is being renovated. But John Harwood of CNBC pointed out that that hard work included a flurry of tweets, nine before 9 a.m., in which the president used the words fake, failing, phony, inept, lied, defrauded, con artist, child, and baby to describe others, while insisting his base is bigger and stronger than ever before. Let's preview the week ahead in politics with Scott Horsley, NPR White House reporter, who joins us from Bedminster, New Jersey, where the president's golf club is located, where he's staying. Hi, Scott.
Robin, good to be with you.
And we'll get to that flurry of tweets, but President Trump did speak with the president of South Korea last night after North Korea vowed revenge against those newly imposed UN sanctions. What came out of that phone call, in that diplomatic move? Serious business there.
This is very serious indeed, and you're right. It follows the unanimous vote by the UN Security Council over the weekend to impose stiff new economic sanctions on North Korea in response to its ongoing nuclear and missile tests. That was a significant accomplishment for the Trump administration, winning the unanimous support of the Security Council, including especially China, which is North Korea's number one trading partner. In fact, Mike McFaul, the former Russia ambassador in the Obama administration, congratulated the Trump team for getting that unanimous support. He called it a genuine foreign policy accomplishment. So in his conversation with Moon Jae-in, President Trump committed to enforcing those sanctions and to leaning on other members of the international community to do the same.
Okay. We want to get your take on the dust-up over the Vice President, Mike Pence, over the weekend, who some would say went to unusual lengths to deny that New York Times story yesterday. It said that he was among the Republicans maneuvering to run in 2020 without Donald Trump. Pence issued a formal statement of denial on a White House letterhead. And advisor Kellyanne Conway denied the story in ABC. She then had this to say about President Trump's poll numbers and agenda.
His approval rating among Republicans and conservative and Trump voters is down slightly. It needs to go up. They are telling him, just enact your program. Don't worry about a Congress that isn't supporting legislation to get big ticket items done. And don't worry about all the distractions and diversions and discouragement that others who are still trying to throw logs in your path are throwing your way.
So should President Trump, though, worry about Mike Pence?
Yeah, Kellyanne Conway, a pollster herself, acknowledging some erosion in the president's support, even among solid GOP voters. But, you know, the thing that was striking was how over the top the vice president's response was. He issued this statement calling the New York Times story disgraceful and offensive, even though that story was careful to note that Pence has done nothing in public to distance himself from this president. In fact, on the contrary, he has been an outspoken and loyal supporter of Donald Trump's. However, the vice president has set up an independent fundraising committee. He has named a political operative to his White House team. And the Times said Pence staffers have been telling some GOP donors the vice president wants to be ready should there be an opening in 2020. Now, that's not particularly remarkable, really, for someone in Pence's position, but he works for a president who values loyalty above all else, and so Pence went out of his way to avoid angering the president.
Well, there's been a lot of heat coming from that NRA recruitment ad that spokeswoman Dana Loesch put out on Friday. It slams the New York Times. Let's listen.
This untrustworthy, dishonest rag that has subsisted on the welfare of mediocrity for one, two, three more decades. We're going to laser focus on your so-called honest pursuit of truth. In short, we're coming for you.
You know, coming from an organization that has guns, that was pretty startling. How's that being viewed?
Yeah, well, the NRA no longer has to worry about beating back gun safety legislation as it did during the Obama era. And so it's really gone on the offensive. And what we're seeing here is kind of the evolution of the NRA from a targeted gun rights organization into a broader player, a broader combatant in the culture wars. We saw this back in April when President Trump addressed the NRA convention down in Atlanta. He was the first sitting president to do that since Ronald Reagan. And Wayne LaPierre, the NRA leader, said at the time they were on the warpath against what he called three enemies: academic elites, political elites, and media elites. That sounds very much in line with the way the president has positioned himself. And there's nothing concealed about the political weapon that the NRA is wielding here.
Yeah. Scott Horsley, NPR White House reporter. Scott, thank you.
Good to be with you, Robin.
And two people were murdered with guns over the weekend in Baltimore, shattering an effort by community organizers who had called for a 72-hour ceasefire among the city's residents. Police say the victims are 37-year-old Dante Johnson and a 24-year-old named Lamontre Tynes. 210 people have been murdered in Baltimore so far this year, and that is well ahead of last year's pace. Erica Bridgeford is one of the leaders who called for the ceasefire. Erica, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Well, you had spent so much time planning for this event, and yet two people were killed over the weekend. Do you feel that you lost?
I don't feel that I lost. There were 41 hours without anybody getting killed, and there was a five-hour space of time where we lost Trey and Dante, and then there was 26 hours without anyone getting murdered. So there were 76 hours of nobody getting murdered in Baltimore, which is a really big deal when people die every 19 hours. And so it's really important to us to remember that 5 hours and those two people, because we were shaken at our roots losing them. For me, it was like when I heard that my brother got killed, or my cousins, or my stepson. And we realized that we must have been a little numb before, because 2 weeks ago when we heard about people getting killed every 19 hours, it didn't take our breath away the way it did this weekend. And so our new focus is don't be numb, raise our vibration even higher, and to remember that 5 hours and how much it mattered to us that these two men were no longer with us.
Of course, and you say that figure, one person every 19 hours, which is shocking, because many people, when they think of violence in American cities, their first thoughts go straight to Chicago. Chicago has reached 400 murders so far this year, but obviously your city is struggling too. What is going on there?
Well, I think it's what's going on in America, so it's no mistake that America's cities, the ones that are historically oppressed and beaten into the ground, are having violence. America has a very violent culture. It's one of the most violent places on earth, and it uses emotional and physical and spiritual violence to oppress people. And it teaches that violence is power all at the same time. So when people feel disempowered, of course they're going to use the same strategies that they see people at the top of the structure using. And so while it is up to all of us to address the root causes of violence and to dismantle those systems as much as we can, it is also up to us to pay attention to how to heal the present traumas of violence when it happens, and then to do the healing in the aftermath of violence.
And that's exactly what you were trying to do this weekend. And in many
that's
ways,
right.
It sounds uplifting. There were prayer services at churches, rallies, cookouts, music, a peace walk, meditations. Hey, did it help?
It was unbelievable. People all over the city talked about how the air felt different. Not only like you don't hear any gunshots at night, or they're not ambulances flying down the street every 5 minutes, but the air literally felt different. People made songs about the Baltimore ceasefire. Like, there are four songs right now. Mm. There's an anthem that has a video. Like, you know you have done something great together when the music documents this time in history. There were over 50 events on the calendar for this entire weekend.
And yet you have so much more to do, right? Because the backdrop to all of this is the conflict that Baltimore has seen with its police department over the past few years, riots after Freddie Gray died in police custody back in 2015, also recent videos that have come up recently that allegedly show police officers planting drugs on suspects. Did this weekend do anything in the community to help bridge that relationship?
Well, I can't really speak to that, because our focus wasn't on police-community relationships. Our focus was on community coming together to heal our city, community coming together to love up on each other and see what we could do if we all tried something together. That was our focus. I can tell you that in my experience with the Baltimore City Police Department this weekend, even leading up to this weekend, it has been T.J. Smith encouraging me in the midst of grieving his own brother. He's been encouraging me for the last few months.
And T.J. Smith is a spokesperson for the Baltimore City Police.
Yes, he is. And Colonel Melvin Russell made sure that there was food at the prayer vigil that happened at the end of the ceasefire. And so when I was crying and very upset as I arrived at the scene where Trey was murdered, a news reporter tried to walk up to me and mic me at that time and stand me in front of a camera. And I was just devastated. And so I had to walk away and cry. And it was a police officer, a black woman with a gold mohawk, and I have a mohawk. So I initially was like, okay, you can come sit with me, you know. But she just sat in silence, and she said, sister, I don't want to disturb your vibe. I just want to sit with you and let you know that I'm here for you. And it's been like that all weekend.
Yeah. That's Erica Bridgeford, a community activist who led a ceasefire movement in Baltimore over the weekend. Unfortunately, that ceasefire did not last, but as you've just heard, still some hopeful signs there in the community. Erica, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Michael Krauser's new book of photography is entirely shot on film, in black and white, and processed in a darkroom. His techniques are used less and less in today's modern world, but they're also well-suited for his subject, whose way of life is also disappearing. Krauser spent 10 years documenting the lives of ranchers working in northwest Colorado. The result is a book called Mountain Ranch. Michael Krauser, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you start by telling me about this place? It's totally, typically Western, right? I mean, it is just screams Western United States.
It absolutely does, but it's also very much Colorado in that it's in the mountains, and it was pointed out to me early on that that's a different kind of ranching, and that's in the end why I called the book Mountain Ranch, because I wanted to show that kind of place and that kind of ranching and also display some of the landscape that makes it so.
So you take these photographs over the course of 10 years, from 2006 to 2016, and
right.
You're following nine families who are making their living off the land and who have done so for many, many generations, sometimes going back all the way six generations. Tell me about the people you photographed.
Well, the people are of that place in every way. A lot of the older people that I interviewed and photographed were actually born on the same piece of land or next door to where they're living now and to where they worked their whole lives and then retired. They're wonderful people. Everybody that I came in contact with was kind to me and friendly and willing. Even if they were somewhat shy, they were willing and interested in having me there to look at and document their way of life.
Were they skeptical of you, an outsider from Minnesota?
Well, you know, when I first started the project, I was actually living in New York, and I think that sometimes that kind of made its way to somebody. So this quote-unquote New York photographer was coming by, and I think maybe some people had some preconceptions about what they were going to meet. But I guess at heart, I'm a Minnesota boy, so, you know, I had a way of relating to people from more rural surroundings, I guess. They were never too afraid of me and were always welcoming, even if it took, you know, a few minutes or a few hours to get used to me.
Well, clearly they ended up liking you. You did this project, as we said, for a decade, and there's something interesting about that because you were able to track how some of the people on these ranches change over time, including a young woman who was just 12 years old when you started. Her name was Madison George.
Yeah, Madison George was a daughter of one of the families from Yampa, Colorado, that I photographed. And I made a portrait of her and some other young people one of my first visits out there in 2006. And the portrait that I made of her just stood out as one that people always wanted to ask about, always wanted to talk about. It's something about the look on her face, the gaze into the camera was somehow arresting and intriguing enough that people always stopped at it and asked about it. And when I finished the project, I realized that I'd been photographing Madison and some other people for 10 full years. And kind of in recognition and honor of that portrait and of her, I asked if I could make one more portrait of her to finish off the project. And so the last picture I made for the book was a portrait that was an attempt to emulate the original one of Madison.
So you track how she changes over time, but one of the fascinating things about the work is that in some way you have showed how this lifestyle, this job has not changed at all over the years. Many of your photographs, as I go through the book, I can't tell whether or not you've taken this photo in 1860, in 1970, in 2016. There is a timelessness to the pictures that you've taken. Did you do that on purpose?
I did do that on purpose, and it's not really an attempt to make old-looking photographs as much as it is to take photographs that don't really reference popular culture, if you can see the difference I'm trying to make there. I really don't include any evidence of popular culture, no tennis shoes or sunglasses or baseball hats or cars or architecture or typography. It's all just the traditional elements of traditional lives. And I really feel like, you know, one picture can contain that, but if you have a whole series like that, you, by the end of it, you feel as though you've had a certain type of experience, I believe.
I think you're right. I think also that it comes down to essentially three main elements in the imagery, which is the men and women who you photographed, the animals that they work with, and the landscape where they're working.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's it.
That's a good observation. There are other elements as far as, you know, photographically speaking. There's a real, I try to pay a lot of attention to things like composition and strong, simple compositions, which I actually think also go a long way towards giving an experience by the end of a book.
Let's talk about some of the photographs. The one that struck me was this picture of a coyote hanging on a barbed wire fence.
Right.
It's dead. Clearly a rancher had just shot it.
Right. Actually, the guy in the next photo shot it.
The next photo is... Oh, yeah. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. He's got a rifle slung over his shoulder.
That's it, yeah.
That's a very Western image, that picture of the coyote hanging on the fence.
Yeah, to me, that was really an important picture in the book because, for one thing, it shows that I wasn't really trying to just romanticize this whole thing. It's a really rough and tough, earthy kind of subculture. Then I wanted to show that was true. And, you know, there is a lot of death in their life. And I wanted to exhibit some of that just to give it a sense of truth.
There's another photo of a rancher. All you can see is his hand. And there is mud just dripping off of it, and I think that's another reference to how hard the work is. I mean, we can sit here in our comfortable perches in a studio and talk about how, you know, what a beautiful life this would be, but you probably had to tackle this idea of sentimentality, how not to make this look too glamorous or something that it's not.
Well, you're right, and I also do have kind of an innate fascination with the rougher elements of their lives. So for me, it was not something I had to talk myself into to photograph the mud and blood and spit and, you know, the whole thing. I spent a lot of days, you know, sitting down in cow manure or kneeling in it, or, you know, it's just part of the deal. And these people finish their days covered with all such things.
And the animals themselves, you can see the struggle that they go through. We mentioned the coyote, but I'm thinking about the cattle, the photographs of these cattle. You can see the something going on in their eyes. You get such close-up pictures of them where you can see the drama they're going through.
Yeah, especially during branding. That's a tough day for those calves. And, a lot of their life is calm and pastoral, but they have some distressing elements to their lives as well. And I wanted to show that, too. I wasn't trying to make any kind of a point about it being a difficult world for animals or people, but it's just what I saw, and I thought it was important to relay as much truth as possible.
So in many ways, the life of a rancher has not changed, but also in other ways, everything has changed about their lives. Big questions about whether or not this lifestyle can continue itself into the future. You get into that at the end of the book, especially in some of the interviews that are done with the people you photographed. I'm thinking of Nick Struby.
Right.
He says his kids would love the ranch to take it on after he passes, but it's just not going to happen, which is a typical problem these folks are facing.
Yeah, there were a number of ways in which people expressed to me that ranching was a disappearing way of life. And one of them was this idea that inheritance taxes would make it impossible for the next generation to just simply take over. As Nick says in his text there, you can't keep selling the same piece of land over and over and keep it going. There's other reasons why people feel that their way of life is not long for this world, including other inheritance issues like splitting up a ranch amongst a whole generation of people, which makes it impossible to continue, or the idea that a young person could not be a new rancher because where would they ever get the money for land and stock and machinery and such? But also there's the development of the land around them, and which takes away land available for cattle ranching, the development of land for residences and recreational land. It's something that really sticks in the craw of these ranchers, this idea that their land is going away. And it kind of sets up a conflict with, you know, what they call rich people coming in and buying up a ranch, a whole ranch that had been used for raising cattle and simply using it for recreation two or three times a year.
Mm. Photographer Michael Krauser, the new book is called Mountain Ranch. And I have to say one thing before I let you go is that the cover of this book is so beautiful. It's a photo of a cowboy in action getting onto his horse's saddle. The cover is just so pretty. I didn't even want to put a thumbprint on it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's a powerful photo of a young rancher named Ryder Becker who was out checking calves, and it turned out to be a really strong picture.
Michael Krauser, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're going to be hearing a lot in coming weeks about the debt ceiling. This is the limit on how much money the country can borrow to pay its bills. We're slated to hit that limit, the ceiling, in late September. In a recent letter, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin called on Congress to raise the limit, but talks between the White House and fiscal hawks in the Senate ended at an impasse. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Robin.
And we have been here before, and it always seems that at the last minute, Congress folds and raises the limit. Isn't that right? I mean, and is this expected to be any different?
Well, that is traditionally the game that's been played over this issue. This time, obviously, the roles are reversed, and Republicans are the ones trying to raise the debt ceiling, and Democrats potentially could resist that. But what's really tricky this time is a couple things. A, the partisan divide has just grown even wider this year. And even all the Republicans aren't on the same page, like you said. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin wants a quote-unquote clean debt ceiling increase, meaning that it be done without any strings attached in the form of big spending cuts. But there's a bit of a question over whether the real conservatives in the House, the so-called Freedom Caucus, whether they will go for that or they will really insist on future spending cuts. And remember, Congress is not returning from recess until early September, so there really isn't a lot of time to hammer out an agreement. Right. So that's got a lot of observers are getting a little nervous
about
it.
Well, I just want to be clear. Any sense that it won't be needed to raise the limit, that there will be so many cuts and just some sort of miracle and it won't be needed?
No, it's definitely going to have to be raised, yeah.
So we heard Steven Mnuchin calling for the raise, but Budget Director Mick Mulvaney argues that just breaching it, just, you know, breaking through without raising it, isn't such a big deal.
Right, and remember, he comes from that House Freedom Caucus, very conservative group of lawmakers. Mulvaney has kind of softened his position a little bit, and the most recent remarks we've seen from him, he's suggested that he's on the same page as the White House now and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin in that he does insist that it get raised without a lot of strings attached.
Okay. Well, the New York Times editorial predicts that not raising the debt ceiling would trigger a major recession. When was the last time it wasn't raised?
Well, it's traditionally been raised. The last time it caused this type of drama was in 2011 when the government got very close to that deadline. And what happened then is Standard & Poor's, the rating agency, afterward actually removed the AAA rating from the U.S. debt. And it did have a lot of sort of ripples throughout the financial markets. The stock market was down about 19% at its worst that year. It ended up recovering and changing the year, little changed, but it was a very dramatic period in the markets.
Right. Well, and, you know, some might ask, if it always gets raised anyway, why do we even have it?
Well, that's a good question. And there have been some who have suggested, why don't we just get rid of this thing? The former Treasury Secretary Jack Lew and others have been among those saying this. But in this political climate, it's kind of doubtful that the conservatives would agree to that.
Yeah, because at least it gives you something that might temper spending,
right,
even if in the long run it ends up getting raised. Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
More than 33,000 animals live at Boston's New England Aquarium, and one man is in charge of keeping them healthy. Charlie Innes started his career as a suburban veterinarian, taking care of dogs and cats, maybe a rabbit or a pet snake. But today, he works in a building that's teeming with many animals you've probably never even heard of. I met Innes as he made his morning rounds. Behind the scenes at the tropical fish exhibit, the aerators are humming in tanks of water that line the walls of this narrow room. We break into a sweat quickly. The thermostat is cranked up, so it always feels like summer.
So, does he have gas in his eye? I haven't seen him yet.
Yes.
Innes peers into a tank with the aquarium's Brianne Dent. A tail spot squirrel fish has a bulging eye.
I want to say it's his left eye. It's hard to see because he's sort of tucked into a tube right now.
Later, the little red fish will be sedated. A needle will draw the gas out. Good as new. Next up, a 45-pound cold water patient.
So this halibut has had problems repeatedly with his abdomen getting very distended.
The team has lowered the flat, prehistoric-looking fish into a holding tank. The water is treated with anesthesia that washes over the fish's gills. The halibut must fall asleep before Innes can remove the staples from a previous surgery.
And if everything looks great, then we're in the clear. If there's any evidence that...
There he goes. He's not quite asleep yet.
He's still awake right now, yeah.
When he's finally asleep, Innes takes the staples out. The wound looks good. As our rounds continue, we see displays of anacondas and piranhas. There's Myrtle, the lovable sea turtle, and these little fellas. Baby African penguins, 42 days old, clamoring for attention behind the walls of their cage.
Well, guys, you sound like a broken record, don't you?
These stinky little furballs represent the pressure that's on Charlie Innes. Many of the high-profile species at the aquarium are either threatened or in danger. African penguins are in sharp decline. Industrial fishing has slashed the bird's food supply, and up to 80% of the population has vanished in the past 5 decades. So, every baby counts.
We have really eliminated most of the types of illnesses that they would experience in the wild. And so it's interesting now in captivity, we see some of the more common things that happen to older people or older dogs and cats. So if the penguins are not being eaten by sharks in the wild or dying from infectious diseases in the wild, eventually something else happens. And so we see older animals here that develop cataracts or diabetes or cancer. It can be challenging but interesting to work with those kinds of cases.
Well, let's talk about that. One of the things I've been noticing as we walk around this aquarium is that there are so many different types of animals. You've got fish, sharks, penguins, octopus. All those systems in those animals must be different. How do you have the expertise to take care of each one of them?
Well, they're different in some ways, but if you look across all of the vertebrate species, they're actually quite similar. So a fish has a liver, you have a liver, a dog has a liver. So a lot of the organ systems are similar, and we really just are taking what we know in other species, domestic species like dogs, cats, horses, cows, and then we apply that information to species that may not be studied that well. When it's time to provide care to an octopus, there's not, you know, a course in school about octopus medicine.
Does that mean that you fail sometimes?
We do fail sometimes. Sometimes we find novel disease conditions or novel infectious agents that have never been reported before, and we're the first to find it. And in that case, we just have to try to extrapolate from other similar situations and come up with a plan. Sometimes that plan may work, but other times the plan fails, and that's just part of what the job is like here.
When I think about your job, I think about the health of the ocean. I've been reading a lot recently about 9 endangered right whales that have died off the coast of Canada. What do you think the health of marine animals are in relation to our oceans?
Well, it's looking a little bit depressing across the board in some capacities. We know that a lot of species are declining in numbers across the world. Sea turtles are a good example. The whales are a good example. And we know that the oceans are full of fishing gear and pollution, and that the chemistry of the ocean is changing from climate change. And all of these things are influencing the species that have evolved in the oceans for millennia. And just within a few hundred years of the human population boom, we're really damaging a lot of these species.
And you're a turtle expert.
It's among the things that I'm interested in. I've been a bit typecast, but yes, turtles are my main interest, yeah.
So, and there's what, about a half a dozen species across the world for sea turtles?
Yeah, sea turtles, there's 7 species. They're all considered endangered at this point, and they're affected by things like being entangled in fishing gear, accidentally being captured by fishing gear, and a lot of their coastal habitat where they lay their eggs has been developed as luxury resorts for humans.
It just makes me think in terms of your job. You're an aquatic vet, but in a sense, here in this place, you're also sort of a conservationist. Does that ring true to you?
Yeah, that's true. All of us here feel like we have a conservation and education job, and that's the reason many of us come to work here. So we're not just taking care of pet animals, but we recognize that we as animal care providers can't solve all of those problems, and we recognize that we need attorneys and politicians and conservation biologists to help us in that mission.
But I know there are people listening to this who don't like places like zoos or aquariums or anywhere where animals are in captivity. Do you think the animals here would be better off in their natural environment?
Yeah, that's. I can't just give a yes or no answer to that. There are animals that live here that live in smaller spaces than they would if they were out in the wild. But many of the animals that live here were born in captivity and would not survive in the wild. And so, you know, we've made choices here. For example, we don't exhibit dolphins here anymore. And that was a conscious choice based on the resources that we felt we could provide to them. So there are things that live here that it's appropriate for them to be here. That's not true probably of every zoo and aquarium in the world.
But some of the animals here are stressed. More than 1 million people visit the aquarium every year, and many of them visit the touch tank to put their hands on stingrays and small sharks. It's taken a toll on Innes's next patient, a horseshoe crab.
He's got some granulomatous tissue on his right third limb.
The crab has lived in the touch tank for 3 years, and a staff member recently noticed it's been lethargic.
He's missing his right fourth limb distally and his right fifth limb distally. And his tail tip is fragmented.
So you're weighing him now?
Yeah, so he's 700 grams.
So what's your take on that animal?
His prognosis isn't great, but we'll put forth a plan and start treating him, but he's got indications that he might be nearing the end of his life based on what we're seeing.
You said he had some fractured limbs, his tail was fractured. Yeah. That happens in captivity or in normal,
well,
the course
happens,
of a normal life?
It happens in the wild too, but captive crabs, especially ones that might be in touch experience exhibits, they may not do well for as long a period of time as they would otherwise.
Well, it makes you wonder if the touch exhibit is a good idea, then.
We discuss these sorts of ethical things all the time, yeah. It's a balance of the educational value of that experience versus the outcome for the animal.
The aquarium spokesman, Tony Lacasse, is standing nearby.
What we're really looking to do is and get empathy from the public to be able to care about this huge habitat. And so in part of that, some of that an interaction can make a big difference in respect to particularly with younger kids, where all of a sudden they're engaged. And then what you hope is that they'll eventually translate to empathy.
But it is tough because I think if a little kid saw that the animal was injured, or if parents knew that bringing their kids into the exhibit to touch the animals could be causing them some sort of distress, that there would be an empathy issue there as well, that they might be concerned that that's what these exhibits can lead to.
Sure, it would be something that, you know, it's a reasonable concern. We do rotate animals off. You know, we won't keep injured animals or real animals on exhibit over that length of a period of time. We have discussions and we change practices over times as well.
Little goldfish in your bowl, I've dug you all day long. Yellow scales rising.
That's the New England Aquarium's spokesman, Tony Lacasse, along with the head vet, Charlie Innes. We've got photos and a video of the baby penguins at hereandnow.org.
Amazon has walloped brick-and-mortar bookstores across the country, but the news isn't all bad. In the Washington, D.C. area, bookstores are appearing to be bouncing back. At least five small independent bookstores have opened there in the last 2 years. More are on the way. Can it be a new chapter for the neighborhood bookstore? Ali Schweitzer from Here and Now contributor WAMU talked to shop owners in the district to find out.
Novelist Jonathan Safran Foer is about to stand at a podium and talk about his new book, Here I Am. He's at the D.C. shop called Politics and Prose, and he's brought a crowd.
If you're here for the event, why don't you come take seats?
This is a typical scene at the independent Washington bookstore, which has been in business since 1984. If online retail and e-readers were supposed to have destroyed local bookstores, there isn't any sign of that here.
Thanks for coming, and please help me welcome Jack this afternoon.
Owners of small bookstores say business has been looking up for the last 6 years or so, and there are a few reasons for that. Bookstore chains Borders and Barnes & Noble have left the district, wiped out by Amazon and a changing business climate. They're also retreating from the suburbs. Plus, publishers have made their terms more favorable to small shops. E-book sales are declining, and there's another less quantifiable factor at work, too.
You know, there's an appreciation that people have expressed for their local neighborhood bookstores.
Bradley Graham co-owns Politics and Prose.
They understand what's at stake. The value of these bookstores to a sense of community and, you know, the process of discovery that goes on in a bookstore as opposed to online retailers.
In other words, despite the convenience of shopping online, people seem to be remembering what they liked about brick-and-mortar bookstores. East City Bookshop is one of D.C.'s newest bookstores, tucked into a tidy basement less than a mile from the Capitol building. Lori Gilman opened the store last year.
I kind of figured if any place could support a bookstore, this was the perfect neighborhood.
Gilman may be right. Capitol Hill is well off, with an average household income of nearly $150,000 a year. But the D.C. region overall seems like the kind of place that would support a bookstore resurgence. One indicator? Almost a quarter of local residents hold an advanced degree, more than twice the national rate. And development is continuing to spread eastward and into the suburbs, bringing more money and more foot traffic into more neighborhoods. That's part of why Jake Kumsky-Whitlock decided to open a new bookstore in the increasingly bustling H Street Northeast corridor. He's one of the owners of Solid State, a bookshop expected to open later this year.
There are so many small little micro communities and neighborhoods in this city now that are kind of their own little worlds. And each one of those deserves a bookstore, frankly.
A bookshop on every corner. It's a nice concept, but it may not be a winning business idea. The future of local indie bookstores is still in doubt.
They are not out of the woods.
Jane Friedman is a publishing consultant based in Charlottesville, Virginia.
The current cultural celebration of independent bookstores, that is not going to save them if there's a widespread minimum wage increase, if their rents increase.
Friedman says bookstores still face the same hurdles as any brick-and-mortar store. Both minimum wages and rents are on the rise in the Washington region, and the average profit margin for bookstores is a modest 2.5%. So today, bookstore owners say, they need to do more than just sell books.
We've been forced to change the way that we operate.
Paul Rupert owns Upshur Street Books. He says shops that have survived tough times have learned how to adapt.
Amazon and the big box bookstores have really put pressure on smaller stores to up our game.
That's what he says his store is doing. Upshur Street Books hosts regular events. They focus on personalized customer service in ways online stores can't. And they stock a lot of non-book merchandise. Things like coffee mugs and greeting cards have higher profit margins than books. Basically, bookstores are getting creative in order to survive. Andy Shalal is taking that creativity to the next level. He owns the local restaurant and book chain Busboys and Poets.
I know people are looking for instant things now. You know, they want to pick up the phone and call and have something delivered to their door.
Busboys and Poets already delivers food, so Shalal thought, why not deliver books?
Would you like a book with that burger? You know?
Shalal says Busboys and Poets plans to debut book delivery this summer. It's the kind of innovation that bookstore owners hope will keep them in business for years to come. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Schweitzer in Washington, D.C.
And this program note as we end the hour. This afternoon on All Things Considered, we'll take a look at the role Fox News played in concocting that baseless story about the death of the young Democratic staffer Seth Rich. We've reported on Seth's story with David Folkenflik. Well, David will take it further today to see how it has echoes for the network's controlling owner Rupert Murdoch, who had to shut down the biggest paper in the UK after an outcry there over its reporting on a missing British girl who was later found murdered. Do you remember that story? If not, David will remind you today on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Jeremy's back tomorrow. This is Here and Now.